Welcome to the Fremantle Press podcast. My name is Rebecca Higgy, and today I'm talking to Brom Bateman about her poetry collection of Memory and Furniture. As a warning to our listeners, today's discussion will touch on sexual violence and trauma, but we'll also be delving into feminism, sex, birth, and the power of words. Bron is a poet, academic, and mother of nine. She has had her work published in journals and collections in Australia, the UK, and the US, and has performed her work at conferences, readings, and festivals across Australia and internationally. Bron, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much.
Now, Bron, what is Of Memory and Furniture about?
Well, it's a collection in four parts, and they're four discrete parts, but they speak to one another, I think. The first part is about my experiences as a mother and poems about my children and about the experience of motherhood. Part two moves into an exploration of sexuality and BDSM experience. Part three addresses relationships, sex, and mental illness. And part four is the section that deals with abuse.
Author Julian Van Loon describes your collection as a deeply feminist project. Can you share a little of the feminist imperative behind your work?
Well, this work was completed as part of my PhD, so I had to be informed very much by the theory that I was using in the creative production. So I used particularly Adrienne Rich, whose work and poetry speaks to me very profoundly about the female experience. I think the fact that it's an embodied collection, it's a collection of experiences that a woman has on her body in a place and time, gives it that feminist imperative, because feminism, I think, is very much about articulating the self through experience and through the body. So that in and of itself, and the fact that I am a feminist, I'm happy to call myself a feminist, and that my writing is informed by that all the time.
Why did you choose to name the collection after the poem Of Memory and Furniture?
Well, it's a collection that deals with memory from the beginning of my memory to my experiences as an older woman. And I see memory as I said, an embodied experience. And so we aren't only located in the body we experience things and the way we remember, but in the locations we find ourselves in. And that particular poem Of Memory and Furniture deals with a specific time and place and location and people and a body that is acted upon. And so for me, that was the best articulation of myself, of myself as a writer and myself as a woman.
As I was reading through it, I did keep coming back to that feeling that memory has a physicality. How does your poem speak to how memory lives in the body?
Well, I wrote a poem many years ago that ended up in my first collection, and it was talking about the seven small darts of scars that I have on my arm from when I was given IVs during the caesarean sections that I had in my reproductive life. And that poem really struck me, that image of the place on the body, and so much of what we experience as women occurs on our bodies, our reproductive history, our personal history, if we're victims of assault, if we're survivors of assault, just the fact that when we have children and when we, you know, menstruation, all of these experiences we have are so much embodied experiences. And I try and capture the memory, because for me, memory has always been a bit problematic because of my history of abuse. I've had gaps in my memory. And for me, to get the embodied experience and reclaim it is a way of reclaiming agency in my own life and in my own experience.
I wonder, do you think poetry is also a way of, writing is a way of reclaiming that as well.
Absolutely. And yeah. I think if we talk later about the editing process and the creation process of writing poetry, we'll talk about the fact that poetry for me is definitely a reclamation and giving it some distance, giving it some creative and artistic expression gives me the necessary distance I need to kind of function, but also allows me to create a piece of work that stands in on its own merits.
I'd love to talk to you about the first part. You talked about the first part of your book is about motherhood and your experiences of birth. And for me as a new mum, these were the poems that really spoke to me. Mm-hmm. I had a huge cry when I read the poem for just 3 minutes. And I won't tell the listeners what that poem's about. I'll just encourage them to go and read it. I had a huge, huge cry reading that, kept having had my son right next to me. I also felt very emotional reading your poems about birth. There was a brilliant line in the poem Intimacy where you write about the tenderless intimacy of medicine. I found this to be a very apt way of describing the coldness of medicine and some medical practitioners when it comes to birth. So I'd really love for you to share some of your insights on birth, particularly how birth changes us as women and how the tenderless intimacy of medicine impacts that change.
What an amazing question. That's such a great question. For me, so much of my reproductive experience is grounded in violence. Mm. And it's violence that's thoughtless violence because it's done to us by medical practitioners, by people who have authority over our bodies at a particular point in time. Mm. And that incredibly invasive intimacy that, you know, literally hands inside our bodies, opening us up and doing things to us, is very violent in its very foundations. Mm. And so for me, I have a great deal of anger because a lot of my experiences weren't the kinds of experiences that are in any way unusual or extraordinary. Mm. Lots of women experience the things that I have with, you know, medication not working properly, doctors who are rough, doctors who are thoughtless, doctors who don't respect our agency over our bodies and ask permission before doing things to us, all of those sorts of things. And I read a very interesting account of Clementine Ford's birth experience, and she said once again it wasn't an extraordinary experience. She just had a reasonably standard delivery, but she was absolutely traumatized by it. And I think many women don't go into these experiences expecting that they will be traumatized, that it will be invasive and cold and tenderless. In the very act that creates the children for us in the first place is all about love and intimacy usually. And this is such a contrast to that. And so for me, I had to write about those experiences in that kind of context.
I think I read somewhere it's 1 in 3 women will experience birth trauma, which is quite shocking.
Shocking. Absolutely shocking.
But, I mean, you see women everywhere with children, I mean, and you just think, wow, how many of these women that I can see have had a traumatic experience?
And I think you talk to any woman and the epidural hasn't worked, or they've been sick, or they've been hurt in some way, or it's gone on longer and they're exhausted, or they've had to have an emergency caesarean. I mean, how often does that happen?
Yeah.
And all of these invasive procedures. And I think, you know, women, when they start sharing their stories, there's a great power in this because there's a universalising of the fact that these things can be traumatic.
The poem that really details some of the horrific things that happened to you during your birth is the poem Language. The moment that really stuck out for me was where you say how you got second-degree burns in your vagina from a speculum that a doctor left in hot water for too long, which to me was just shocking. But again, I was like, it just kind of, again, one of those parts that just bore into my heart. And I just, yeah, feeling the true violence of this in you creating a life, but then having violence acted upon you. Yes. So
and I was
horrendously.
I was 20 years old when this happened. It was my first baby. I had no friends who were having babies. I was the first in my group to have a child, and this experience was profoundly shocking to me and so painful.
Oh,
and
he
just kind of apologized, but without really intent behind it or an understanding. And
of
it was
it
the midwives who I spoke to afterwards who made my response normal. They normalised my response that this was an outrageous thing to happen.
Yeah.
And they apologised, you know, profusely on his behalf. But it was, yes, it was a shocking experience.
Yeah, and that's not the only shocking thing that is in the poem. What's interesting in the poem is that it goes between these violent acts that's committed against you to acts of sex. And the last line of the poem is, "Tie me up all you like, I'm still a feminist." So in the midst of all this violence, this is a very powerful statement. So can you talk a little bit about this poem for us?
Well, I think, once again, talking about embodied experience and my experience as a feminist, all of these things that I choose to do as an agent of my own body with the relationship that's mentioned in this poem. The contrast for me is so vivid between the acts of control that I choose to cede to and the acts of control that were forced upon me in a medicalized, institutionalized fashion. And so there is a stark contrast for me. And for people on the outside looking in, perhaps those two different balances aren't so apparent. But for me, who was living that experience, the difference was so profound. The difference that I had as a woman who was making decisions about what she wanted to do with her body and the things that I didn't have any control over.
You know, as I was reading this collection, I couldn't help but wonder, is trauma inevitable to a woman's experience? What do you think?
This is a really hard question to answer because I hate kind of feeding into this mentality of woman as victim. And I really, I absolutely categorically deny that. I think women are so profoundly powerful and able to have agency over their life and their bodies. But I do think that physical pain and as a result of this, sometimes trauma, is perhaps an inevitable part of being a woman. I think we're so, you know, we're so deeply imprecated in our bodies and what they do and how we use them and the fact that they grow children for us and we feed those children and we have a reproductive life of many years and all of these things happen. So I don't want to take away the agential kind of control of women, but I do think that the physical experience of women is often one of pain and trauma.
But I think thinking about that distinction, like even though we can experience tremendous pain, I think often if we have agency, that pain doesn't necessarily have to own us.
That's right. And and it's often pain for a purpose. You know, the pain of childbirth, whether it's a vaginal delivery or a cesarean section, it's pain for a purpose. You know, we have a child at the end of it. And so that kind of joy, how things are undercut, these difficult situations are undercut by joy and promise and hope for the future, kind of gives them some kind of resonance for us.
So we've talked a lot about the violence that can be done to women's bodies, but you've also mentioned agency. So I'd love for you now to talk about some of the poems that speak to how the body can have agency and power beyond the violence that is sometimes done to it.
Well, I think I write a lot about sex, and for me sex is very important. It's important in my relationship. It's important for me as part of my sexuality, my sexual orientation, and my experience of my body. So I write about these things from the perspective of pleasure, from the perspective of joy, from the perspective of connection and intimacy and all of the things that make our lives meaningful and worthwhile. Mm. And so for me, there are some poems in the collection that are just full of joy and full of love and the relationships that I've been fortunate enough to have during my life with men and with women. And I've been so fortunate with the partners I've had who have treated me respectfully and lovingly and kindly, and all of those experiences have been so positive for me. So, you know, I do write, obviously, from a perspective of trauma and childhood trauma, but my life has been filled with joy and and connection as well.
I did wonder, you say you've a lot of your poems about sex, so why did you decide to write about something that some people would consider to be very private?
Well, I think for two reasons. One, because it's part of my experience, and this is obviously a very personal collection. And two, because I wanted to open up a dialogue of women's sexuality and women's expression of sexuality. And so often that gets elided. We see, as a queer woman, I see lots of writing that queer men do about queer male sex. And it's, you know, it's quite pervasive in our in the queer culture. But for a queer woman, writing about sexual experience and sexual pleasure, this is less common. And whenever I find it, I'm so thrilled to find it somewhere. I read assiduously and collect it and write it down and write out the lines that I love and all of those things. So, you know, I think I know that sex is private, but sex is also about power and sex is also about privilege. And I think by writing these things, writing my experience, writing perhaps a different perspective of sexuality than some people would be familiar with or comfortable with, is opening up the possibility of a dialogue, not only with my readers, but with people in general. I feel really, you know, passionately about doing that, about articulating myself, my full self.
I also wondered, because like you say, or like I was saying, you know, it's considered sometimes to be a private thing. Some people would perhaps find it shocking to have poems about sex, especially from a queer woman. What kind of reaction have you received, and how do you respond when someone finds a poem, you know, scandalous or offensive?
I've had a vast range of responses. I've had far more positive responses, I must say, than I've had negative responses. I've had people, I can remember once at a reading, a man came up to me afterwards and said that he was aroused at my reading. And I was really dumbfounded by that response at first. But then I thought that was his way of connecting with me in a way that he understood and made sense to him. And so I wasn't as shocked as I kind of initially was with that kind of response. But I've had people come up and thank me for being so open about the way that I write, the things that I say, that a woman like me can write about things like that, and I'm not young. I am, you know, a particular kind of woman. I'm an academic. I'm a mother, and often sexuality and sexual expression gets lost from those representations of self, particularly the mother. And yet, as a mother, you know, you're grounded fundamentally in your sexuality and your experience of sexuality and how that plays out in the creation of children. So for me, they're all really interconnected. And so when someone finds my work scandalous or shocking, I want to engage with them on a personal level and say, what's your experience been? Why? What is it that you've experienced, that you understand about the world, that's making this so difficult for you to hear? And often you get a story about some kind of trauma or experience in the past, or some kind of difficulty with expressions of openness or what have you. And so, you know, often a really meaningful conversation can result from someone who initially finds the material shocking.
Yeah.
So I would say, you know, read it, and if you want to talk to me about it, that's what we can do.
Yeah, I there were many moments when I was reading that I just wanted to have a sit down with you, not with like microphones, but actually sit down and talk to you as another woman and tell you, like, I've experienced this. Or so I think a lot of people will get that when they read this collection. Something will speak to them at a very deep level. I did want to pick up on something you just said. You said a woman like me, and you used scare quotes just then. So I think a lot of people will appreciate that perhaps this is a voice that's not been heard very often.
Yes.
Yeah.
And that on the surface I appear like a average, middle-aged, middle-class white woman with all of the privileges and responsibilities that that entails. Mm. But I have my own rich story, as do we all.
Yeah.
Yes. And I love the quote from Margaret Atwood, who says, in the end, we all become stories, and we've all got stories to share with one another about our experience.
Mm. I wonder if poetry as a medium kind of leads itself more to those very personal stories, those stories that come straight from the heart, or things that are maybe taboo or unseen. What do you think as a poet?
I agree with you entirely. I think for me, the poems that move me, the writers who move me the most, Sharon Olds, Anne Sexton, Adrienne Rich, Mark Doty, they're writing about events in their own lives and in the real world. And I don't have time for facile, shallow explorations of things. I want to get to the guts of the matter. And I think poetry, like the poetry I write and the poetry I read, does try and speak to the heart of the matter.
Mm. Well, it's remarkable, really, to think, you know, you can read a whole novel and maybe have a cry at one point, at the end of it perhaps, but then, like, you can have maybe 20 lines and, you know, have such a profound emotional effect on a person. It's quite a remarkable medium, really.
That concentration of emotion and intent works together so well in the poetic form, and that's why the structure of the poem, the writing itself, is so important to me. It's not enough just to relay an experience. It has to be constructed tightly and formally and with intent, so that the writing is as important as the message, as the theme, as the story.
I am very keen to talk to you about the process of writing, but I've got one more question about a poem that's entitled Talisman. And this I found to be a very powerful poem. It's a list of things like, if I was this, if I wasn't that. And it ends in the statement, he would not have dared. When I showed this poem to a male friend, I was really surprised that he didn't fully understand it. And I kind of felt like I had to explain it. Can you tell us a little bit about this poem and what it speaks to, and perhaps maybe why my friend didn't perhaps have the same response as maybe I did?
I think for women, we live a life every day in the world that's constructed in fear. And I think even if we are safe and we are in the daylight hours and we are, you know, going to our car or going about our lives or whatever, we have to be careful. And I've actually done this research to demonstrate to my students the difference between male experience and female experience, and ask them to talk about what happens when they leave a place and go to their car. And the number of women who say, I'm on the lookout, I've got my keys out, I'm watching, listening out for sounds. And the male students, young men between 18 and 20, they're just, well, I go to the car.
Yeah.
And there's not that construction of danger.
Mm.
And I think to be a woman is often, even when we're safe, it's dangerous.
Yeah.
And I think for a lot of men, even men, even well-intentioned men, even men who have very strong, profound feminist ideals, even men who love women and care for women and support women, find that reality difficult to understand.
Mm. It's just not part of their experience.
It's just not part of their experience.
Mm.
And the only, I think, perhaps the only kinds of men who understand are queer men who can be in danger at night or, you know, on their own, or, you know, trans men, trans women who experience far higher degrees of assault than other people. So they would experience that kind of that sense of danger, I think. But for most men, it's not part of their lexicon.
Yeah. And I wonder if men reading these poems will perhaps get an insight into the female experience.
So.
Yeah.
Yes.
All right. Now, I'd love to talk about the writing of the collection and the power of words. In the poem God in the Details, you write, "I know this day will eventually become a poem." So I really wanted to know, what does that feel like when you have that feeling that something will become a poem? How do you know when something will become a poem?
It's dreadful. I become this observer of my own life, in a sense, and my own experience, which can be a bit dislocating.
Mm-hmm.
And, for example, for my partner, she often says, "I know what you're thinking," and, you know, switch off, come back to me, and so that's part of it. But I make sense of the world by the way I write, and so much of my life is material for my poems, and so I do have these moments where I'm like, take this in. Absorb this in every one of your senses so that you can recreate this moment later on in a poem. And so it is a wonderful feeling because it's reliving the experience twice. You experience the experience in the moment, and then you get the chance to articulate it, create it, tailor it, fix it up, smooth off the rough edges and turn it into a piece of writing. And for me, that's a wonderful way to live.
Mm.
And when we talk about memory, it's a way of reclaiming memory for me. If I can reclaim the moment and the experience and who I was with and how it felt and those moments, then it becomes part of my life and part of my experience.
Mm. And so then just thinking about that, you know, capturing the poem, then I wonder about the editing of a poem. So what is the editing process like for a poem when you work with a publisher or an editor? What is it like?
Well, my experience has been with Fremantle Press, and it's been the most wonderful experience because for me, having my work valued and having my opinion valued is so important and has been such a profoundly pleasurable aspect of the editing process.
Mm.
It can be very difficult to see a poem and know that it's not right and just not know what to do with it. And I've had poems like that where I've known that I'm missing something or it's not working in some way, and you can get so close to your own work that it can be hard to do that. And that's where an editor stepping in with fresh eyes, with a fresh sensibility, can say, look, you know, what you're actually doing is this thing in this verse, and if you chop off those two lines at the end, you've got your poem. And suddenly a piece of kind of inchoate mess becomes something well-fashioned and articulate. Mm. And it's just been the most amazing experience for me. And I work so hard at the structure of my poems. That's very important to me. They have to first and foremost work as pieces of creative production. Mm. And that's part of my experience doing my PhD, a creative PhD, and knowing that they had to be right. It wasn't just enough to get some ideas on a page or, you know, share my experiences, but not have them crafted and articulate and relatable, all of those things that are important.
I then wonder, because as you're talking, I'm thinking about my own experience of writing fiction. And, yeah, it's the same thing. There can be a section or paragraph that's just not working. And then I've had Kate, the publisher, just point out a particular thing and I'm just like, oh, I can fix it now. Oh, this is so good. Thank you.
It's such a wonderful feeling.
It's really nice.
Yes. Georgia would send me edits of poems and I would be so happy to have something that was working on the page and that she understood the intention behind what I wasn't getting. Mm. And that's as important, that to have a sensitive, intelligent reader and editor of your work is the most valuable thing as a writer. So I'm very lucky.
Yes, absolutely. Talking about structure, you mentioned before, now you've mentioned that the collection is split into four parts. Why did you decide to do this?
Because I think I wanted to talk about my different experiences as a woman. Mm. And so they were grounded in different kind of aspects that were all interconnected. Mm. And for me, they had to go together. I remember printing them out and laying them on the floor and putting them together in piles and then shifting them and making sure that I was happy with the way they were organised. There was nothing random about the placement. And sometimes I had them in the wrong place and a couple of them have been moved. Mm. But on the whole, you know, the structure I had in mind that I envisaged for my writing is pretty much what we've ended up with. Mm. And they're discrete sections. They can be read independently, but I think they speak to an overarching narrative that talks about my entire experience as a woman, as a mother, as a lover, as a child, all of those different experiences.
Mm. I want to talk about the poem My Tattoo 1 and My Tattoo 2. In the first poem, you write about getting a poem tattooed to your bicep. And in the second one, you write, "What noun did I want spoken on my skin my whole life through?" So I can't help but ask, what noun did you want spoken on your skin your whole life through?
I wish I knew the perfect thing. Yeah. I actually had a line of Mark Doty tattooed on my bicep. It was my first tattoo. Mm. And I got it back when I was 42, so 13 years ago. Mm. And I've since had it covered up because it wasn't done very well and it all bled out and it didn't look very good. But it said, "What colour is the underside of our skin?" Mm. And that to me, I love Mark Doty because he asks those incredible questions. Mm. And so I have another line of his, "What did you think that joy was some slight thing?" Mm-hmm. And so for me, speaking those kinds of truths about myself and about my experience on my body is so important. And so tattooing is a very important part of who I am. Mm. And my tattoos are a very important part of my identity. Mm. And so there are a number of nouns that I've wanted spoken on my skin, but it's about truth and about being truthful and open.
So what do you think then about, you're talking about being truthful, something that speaks to you. I'd love you to expand a bit more on the power and the importance of words and how we see ourselves and our world. big question.
It is a big question. And I think for me, being a writer is the way I engage with the world. Mm. And the stories I tell are part of my engagement with the world. And the power of words. I learnt to read at four or five, and started swallowing books from that time. Mm. And I've always made sense of the world by my connections to literature. Mm. Through writing myself. I started writing poems when I was 8 years old. I wrote my first collection, five pages of poems when I was 9 years old. My mother made me take it in and show the teacher, and the teacher said to me, "You're going to be a writer someday."
Oh, that's lovely.
And it was such a wonderful, affirming message. Even then, that was my aspiration, to be a writer, to tell stories. And I was very much an observer of my life, even as a child. I had my eye on what was happening to me and what was happening to the people around me. And I think that's part of a kind of trauma narrative. You do have that sense of being removed from your life. But the power of words to escape into through books, through poems, through stories, finding myself in characters, Jo March, Anne of Green Gables, Katie, you know, those sorts of characters who moved me and made me want to write and made me want to be assertive and opinionated and all of those things. So words are our coin. You know, we take for granted the fact that we speak to one another every day, and language becomes debilitated sometimes. Mm. But when we write, it assumes an importance and a permanency that spoken words don't. Yeah. And so for me, words, written words, are the most magical and powerful thing. Mm.
I think you're going to be describing the experience of many of our listeners, including myself, because I was that kid. I can't remember when I learnt to read. I just remember always reading. And I think I was 5 or 6 when I wrote a little book with all these fairy stickers my mum gave me, but I misspelt the word fairy every time. And I gave it to mum and she didn't say a word. I found it when I was 20 and I couldn't believe she never commented on it. Her reaction was just, "Oh, I love it. It's brilliant. You should write something else." And that really...
Oh, that's wonderful.
I think if she'd been critical, I may not have felt like I should write again. But I agree with you that there's something about the written word. We speak to one another every day, but the written word has a permanence and a power. I even think about dedications. So for the first time in my life, I've had to think about who do I want to dedicate this book? My book took 12 years to write. Who do I want to dedicate this to? And likewise, I think was this your second collection?
Yes, but it was, once again, it was 12 years in the making.
Wow.
So I feel your connection, your long-term commitment and connection to a piece of writing. So congratulations for that. It's amazing. it is, the permanency of it is so important, and that dedication, that passing down of time and where you were in a particular time and place, and you will always be in that collection, in that time and place, even when you move on. And that's really important as a writer, I think, to understand that.
I also wonder, at home I've got a bookshelf that's full of things that I've had published, and my husband's also a writer. And we keep thinking, one day our son will read this. And then I'm thinking, will he even care? So do your children read your poems? Are they interested in your writing?
They are very interested in my writing.
Oh, that's
awesome. Wonderful. Because some of the material they're a little bit squeamish about, obviously.
Of course.
Because I'm their mother and I'm framing myself in a way that is difficult for adult children to appreciate. But they're so supportive of my writing. They've always come to readings in Perth. They've, you know, some of them have read early drafts of my work and given me feedback. They're incredibly supportive and very proud, and it's just wonderful. Mm. And it's wonderful for them to see me in a different light, to be published, to have my story told, not only the stories that my family know, but that other people who are strangers will know as well.
Mm.
And that affects them, and I think in a very positive way.
Yeah. Well, that's wonderful to hear. I would love to end today with some of your poetry, but before we do, I have one last question, and this was the thing that I thought the most about. So as we've discussed, this collection contains moments of significant trauma, and as I read certain poems, I wondered, how do I ask you about these things, or even is it right to ask you about these things? I then thought about the public nature of the writer. So if we write about deeply personal or traumatic things, can the reader expect us to talk very openly and answer questions about these things? Do we get to keep anything for ourselves, or in making it public, do we then grant the reader the right to probe?
I think that's a very profound question, and it goes to the very nature of privacy and confession.
Mm.
And while I wouldn't term myself as a confessional poet, there is obviously a very strong aspect of autobiography in my writing, and I don't shy away from that.
Mm.
And so in a sense, I have opened myself up and my life for examination by people who aren't intimately engaged with me.
Mm.
So people other than my family, people other than my wife.
Mm.
And there is sometimes embarrassment in that, sometimes difficulty, sometimes there's contradiction and confusion. But at the same time, I don't shy away from anything that's happened to me.
Mm.
I've had many experiences, both positive and negative, both traumatic and joyful. And I feel that it's really important. And in this particular climate, this political and social climate, it's so important to be open and to articulate a variety of voices and stories. And so in that sense, I refuse to be constrained.
Mm.
I refuse to not answer questions. I refuse to be embarrassed by my life.
Mm.
I'm going to answer every question that somebody asks. And if I find it difficult, I'll say, okay, this is really hard for me and I'm finding it difficult to talk about, but it's important that I do that. And thank you for pushing me, and thank you for asking me that question, because only in that way do we really reach one another. And I think that that's a really important part of being a writer and being a human.
I think that's tremendously brave. I don't think I would necessarily want to do that. And I think some of my nervousness about as my book comes is the fear of those questions. What advice would you have to me about trying to get over that fear?
I think if it matters enough, as long as someone's not asking you questions for shock value or to poke a stick at you in some way, you know when people are doing that. And I think they're really easy to deal with. Then you just say, I'm sorry, that's beyond the scope of what we're talking about, and I'm just not going to engage with that.
Mm.
But most people are asking out of a genuine desire to know you better and to understand you and your work better. And in that kind of spirit, I feel that if you are brave and if you are generous with yourself and kind to yourself, you will give the best articulation of yourself that you can.
Mm.
And that might mean touching on something that's a bit difficult or a bit painful or, you know, that's private, but that's not necessarily a bad thing.
Mm.
That's about getting to connect with people better.
Wonderful. Thank you very much, Bron. I've got a lot out of today.
Thank you so much. I've really enjoyed myself.
Yeah, I think I could go for another half an hour or so. Yeah, let's go get coffee. But before we finish, I'd love for you to read one of your poems for us. So what are you going to read for us today?
I'm going to read Language because I think it's kind of the best articulation of all the themes in the collection. It touches on a little bit of everything, and it's the poem. I read this poem for my wife because it's my wife's favourite poem and the one that she always refers to when we talk about my work.
Mm.
So I would like to write it in dedication to her.
Oh, lovely. Please, fire away.
At 20, I have my first child, bruising soft and black as summer plums from the base of my belly to the middle of my thighs, and a second-degree burn inside my vagina. The speculum sits too long in hot water. The doctor apologises. The person who tops me is also my friend. We talk for hours before he touches me for the first time. Negotiate. I tell him what I like, where I learned about the inadequacy of words, and about what it is my body can do. At 22, my second episiotomy, a lateral cut made without anaesthetic into the perineum to facilitate the delivery of my baby's head, is stitched too tight. I will tear a little and bleed every time I have sex for the next 5 years, even after cortisone injections into the wall of my vagina and an offer from the same doctor who got it wrong in the first place to recut and restitch me. I will learn to forgo the pleasures of spontaneous sex and of being on top. What I feel with him often isn't pain, it's intense sensation. At 23, the family doctor will press too hard on my cramping belly while his other hand is deep inside my cunt. He'll chat about his adult son as he pulls out his forearm, wrist, hand, red and shiny as plastic. Either my blood or my baby's. Never mind, he'll say, his back to me. They're a dime a dozen, meaning miscarriages. This is my first. I am 24. My son is 3 months old and dead. 25, 27, 28. Three more babies, blood transfusions, antepartum and postpartum hemorrhages, a secondary degree tear, twins lost at 3 months of pregnancy, secondary infections, waking up after corrective surgery with a torn perineum from being fucked too hard by an obstetrician with a speculum. Not to labour the point, but while I was unconscious. At 31, miscarriage. 32, baby. 33, another miscarriage. A final fling at 35, a break from study. My last child. I seed so he can take. He seeds. I choose to yield. You're all fine with this, right? Pain, blood, needles, cutting, anaesthetic, being held in place, held still with Velcro and metal, with drugs, by doctors and nurses, once by an anaesthetist because the epidural didn't take, and being confined to a bed, by drips and IV lines, by DVTs and temporary paralysis. I tell him, tie me up all you like. I'm still a feminist.
That was Bron Bateman reading from her book of Memory and Furniture. You can find it at fremantlepress.com.au and all good bookstores. Bron, thank you very much.
Thank you, Beck. I have had a wonderful time, and thank you so much for your insight and your wonderful questions and your brilliant self. It's been lovely to connect with you again.
Yeah, likewise. It's been an absolute pleasure. And I think a lot of people will really get a lot out of this podcast and a lot out of your book. So
thank you so much.
If you've enjoyed today's chat, subscribe to our podcast on iTunes, Google Play, SoundCloud, or wherever you get your podcasts. My name's Rebecca Hickey, and I've been your host today. As the winner of the 2019 Fogarty Literary Award, I'll be talking to amazing people like Bron until my book, The History of Mischief, is released in September. Join me next time as we delve into the inner worlds of writers and wordsmiths.